You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the only madness in our march is Sparta. That BuzzFeed released a pop-punk adjacent list called The 31 Songs from the Aughts That Understood Your Teen Angst isn't revelatory. BuzzFeed lists are as diverse and shallow as NBC's annual slate of new fall shows. Still, like Hannibal, they've stabbed at something insightful this time. Scrolling through the page and scanning the comments reveals a surface-level reading of the concept of angst. The lyric choices focus on sex and rejection. The commenters complain that 90s grunge like Nirvana and Pearl Jam is much more angsty. What I want to know, though, is when did angst become so material? When did it become the exclusive purview of teenagers? Doesn't anxiety and worry about your life come from not realizing or not knowing your own values? Our culture talks about adulthood being about possessing the ability to compromise calmly. Except we approach that compromise the same way we do our angst, with complete disregard for our principles. You can't sit at the negotiating table with someone who doesn't understand what you stand for. You can't sit at it if you don't understand what you stand for. In those cases, there's no such thing as compromise. It's just giving and taking. Joining me this week, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. How are you, Daniel?
Getting heady in the intro.
Yeah, I think my delivery's a little off.
Yeah, that talk about angsty.
Yeah. Jesus. I didn't even say Daniel right. I didn't even have the same patter.
I know. You should curl up in a ball and listen to some Kurt Cobain.
Oh, please, God, no. Did you say that you liked it, though?
Yeah, it's a little different take for you. Gives the show a little depth.
Oh, damn it, I was going to say I was trying to give the show something different. You took my joke. It took my jerks. Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. How are you, Elliot?
I'm angsty. Very angsty. As some of you might not know, or maybe you do if you've ever been to Florida, we don't really get a spring. We don't even get a fall. We get 2 days of what could be considered winter, and the rest is just sweating our balls off summer. And guess what we're in the middle of right now?
Sweating your balls off?
Sweating our balls off.
Don't you like sweaty balls, though?
Not when it's mine and not when it's sweating for a bad reason, like too much heat and humidity in the air.
Yeah, but go F yourself because you don't have to deal with snow. That's what I have to say about that.
Yeah, and we only have two seasons out here in California, summer and kind of not summer, sort of, maybe.
Summer and June.
Exactly. All right, let's end this intro with what Starbucks ended. It's the news with Daniel T. Richards.
After a valiant week trying to combat racism in America, Starbucks corporate head Howard Schultz told employees on Sunday they will no longer be encouraged to write #RaceTogether on drinks cups. But the company's efforts to promote discussion of racial issues is far from over. If you've ever seen a picture of Howard Schultz, you don't need to. He looks like the white corporate villain in every relativity media film. He very much is the picture of the social justice warrior white privilege. Man, look at that guy. Look at that perfect graying hair and the hands outset like fucking Monty Burns. This picture is ridiculous.
I didn't realize that that campaign was only running for a week. Is that true?
Yeah, it's been a week. 1 week. End of an era. Mm-hmm. So did any of you get Race Together on your cup when you went to Starbucks?
No, that's weird because I went to Starbucks several times this past week and at no point did that ever happen.
So you encountered racism at Starbucks? Is that how you felt?
Racism and homophobia, apparently. Gosh. I mean, even a little ethnic bigotry. I mean, a tiramisu latte. Tiramisu, that's Italian. I mean, they're just appropriating Italian culture.
I did not know this was going on. Now my protest, my boycott of Starbucks will continue.
I went to Starbucks several times, hoping that they would write race together on my cup so that I could throw it back in their face and say, fuck you, I'm Hispanic, don't judge me by the color of my skin, essay.
Wait, do they only give it to white people? Is that the idea?
I don't know. I don't know what the idea was. We were supposed to talk about race relations with our barista.
Stupid. Stupid. And you know what I want to talk about when I'm at a Starbucks? I want to talk about, hey, that cute barista over there. What's his name? What's his phone? You know, give me his phone number. That sort of thing. I don't want to talk about racial tension in the country. Starbucks is the one place we're supposed to go where we don't have to talk about this shit. We just sit in our seats. We have our headphones on, listening to our iPhones and iPods, and we're just sipping our Trenta-sized Valencia orange Starbucks refreshers. And I do not want to talk about race relations. I do not want to talk about social justice. Leave me the hell alone when I'm at a Starbucks, okay?
When I go to Starbucks, I want to talk to everybody about the first two pages of their script they're writing, because that's all they have done.
Indeed, with their MacBooks open. But I think more egregious here is that that we have to do this at all. And I don't just mean talk about race, because we can talk about race, whatever. I have no problem with that. What I have a problem with, why do corporations have to pretend to care now? Are we in the era of I have to have a close personal relationship with everything I put in my body or everything I buy or everything I look at or everything I interact with on the fucking internet? By the way, this is coming from someone who does social media for a living. I don't want to have a deep personal relationship with Starbucks. You know what I want from Starbucks? Shitty coffee. That's all I want from Starbucks. Burnt, shitty coffee.
I had the same reaction you did, and I think it's an issue of people not being able to think in essentials, because you do want to pick the companies you support and the products you buy based upon having a knowledge of how they create their products, right? Like, you don't want to support somebody who has sweatshops.
I don't know. It depends. Are they bringing people out of poverty with their sweatshops?
Okay.
First of all, look.
You know what I mean. You get
when
what
I
my
went
point.
To McDonald's as a child, which if anyone has seen my childhood pictures, they know I went more than I should have. I went to McDonald's as a child. You know what happened when I went to McDonald's? I ordered a cheeseburger. I handed them money, and they gave me a cheeseburger. No one talked about race. No one thought about the evil corporate culture of McDonald's. No one talked about minimum wage. All I wanted was beef and dairy. And all they wanted was money.
I agree with you. And what I was saying, I was using sweatshop because I thought that would be like an agreement on something just that's bad. But
nope.
I get the point. I get the point you're making. If they have to slaughter children, okay? Can we agree on that? Slaughtering children is bad. Can we agree there?
If they have to actually squeeze the babies to get the oil.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
If that's how they get baby oil, you would not want to support that baby oil company, correct?
Okay. If we were actually putting babies on, like, in the Juice-O-Matic, like the will it blend thing, and getting the oil out of them, I would probably have a problem with that.
Right.
Yes.
So the point I'm making is I at least have standards as to why, you know, how a company makes their product or why they make their product or that kind of thing. But I don't care about, you know, like you're saying, McDonald's stance on race, because that doesn't have to do with what McDonald's is creating. Same thing with Starbucks. I don't care about their stance on race. But people care about these things now because, A, they can't think in essentials, and B, everyone's essentialized the same things as being important for everyone. Because the way social justice warriors have taken over the conversation. You know, it's about race. It's about homosexuality. Now we're seeing it's about transgender. All of these things define every person and every corporation no matter what. Even though it has nothing to do with coffee or nothing to do with cheeseburgers.
And what's stupid is that I mean, they're talking about race being a problem, but Starbucks is a perfect example of how racism is virtually non-existent in America. I mean, there was a news story today about in Singapore where an anti-Semitic mob stormed into a synagogue and basically, like, razed it to the ground. We really don't have that here. I mean, in most places in the United States of America, we've done very well. And Starbucks, a black person, a white person, gay, straight, Christian, atheist, you know, objectivist, Kantian, we can all stand in one line and order coffee with one another, maybe have a little pleasant conversation, you know, a little, hi, how are you, how are you, and get our coffee, and then we move on. We sit at the same, I mean, we could be sitting at a booth, they might be sitting at the table over, they might be sitting elsewhere, outside on the patio, but the point is, it is a perfect example of how racism and discrimination, a non-objective discrimination is very low in most Americans' lives.
It's
a perfect melting coffee pot.
It's a perfect cup.
You only say that because you've never been to a Starbucks in Ferguson.
That's true. I have been.
Point of order. Ferguson has a Starbucks? Don't go to that Starbucks.
I don't know. I was just making that up. And you also said the polite conversation thing because you've never been to a Starbucks in Southern California.
No, that I have never been. I mean, I'm basing it off of my experience as a Southern boy here in the South.
Yeah.
Whenever I went to a Starbucks in Southern California, I was always first accosted by someone with a clipboard outside who did not work for Starbucks, but who wanted me to sign some petition to ban something or raise some tax on some evil white rich person. Which was not pleasant. And then two, the only thing I ever encountered in Southern California Starbucks was people who were baffled by this newfangled restaurant, beanery. They had no idea what it was, and all they did was stare at the menu for 45 minutes going, I couldn't possibly choose. I would have no idea if the tea or the coffee or the whatever this is. Why is that? Why are people in Southern California universally confused by the Starbucks menu?
All I know is here in Florida, when you go to a Starbucks here in Orlando, at least, it's filled with like Disney cast members that are like off on that, on their, you know, and they're just needing coffee or they're needing tea or something so that they can go off and play in the theme parks on their days off.
Can I ask though, what was trying to be accomplished by this race together? Because if I got a cup of coffee that said race together on it, or a cup of anything that said race together on it, I would think it was an advertisement for some like half mile or mile they wanted me to run. Like,
or like Fitbit or something. Oh, that would have been a smart thing. Encouraging people with your coffee to get like MyFitnessPal or get a Fitbit or Jawbone or something like that and improve their physical fitness. Now that I can go along with.
I picture a nationwide three-legged race. Like literally racing together.
Yeah, see, that makes more sense. Why? Because you say the word, I just don't get it. Like, I don't understand. Like, who came up with this?
I can see Justin at line now, puts race together on it, and Justin turns around and goes, go! And out the door.
That would happen. If somebody handed me that cup and somebody else yelled go, my first instinct would be to run. Wouldn't yours?
My first instinct is never to run, Justin.
So, so you're saying that you haven't seen enough movies that if something's mysteriously written on your cup and somebody else yells go, you're not thinking, fuck, I better run or someone's gonna shoot me.
Well, if there was a man in a striped shirt firing a gun into the air, maybe. But, at least Starbucks isn't trying to poison us. I mean, maybe with ideology, but not with literal poison. Unlike a 12-year-old girl in Colorado, 12 years old, who tried to poison her mother twice, not once, but twice, because her mother took her iPhone away.
It's over. We witnessed the farce. There's no more farce to witness. It's over. This is it.
You say that, Elliot, but there'll be something more ridiculous next week. There always is.
For some reason, this very much reminds me of the Adam Carolla segment, Definitely Not a Jew. But, so the woman first fell sick on March 2nd after drinking a smoothie. That's the first problem. She noticed a smell of bleach coming from her glass.
That's why she didn't think it was poison that time, because she was like, well, I did drink a smoothie.
She noticed the smell of bleach coming from her glass, and then she assumed her daughter hadn't rinsed it properly. But then a few days later, she smelled the bleach again, and she confronted her preteen, who said that she wanted her dead for taking away her iPhone.
I don't think
kids these days.
We can't out-farce this story. I mean, I think this just symbolizes our culture, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, entitlement, mine, mine, mine. You can't take things away from me. I get to use force against you. Yeah, it's got it all. I mean, if she was a lesbian social justice warrior, something or other,
then be a hero.
Transgender.
No, she would be a hero, especially if her mom was white. Yeah, I don't plan on giving my kids anything outside of their cage. So, no smartphones.
This is another reason not to have kids. I mean, first of all, you're bringing them into a world that's probably going to fuck them up, and now they're going to kill you over it? Like, why? Why expose yourself to this?
Do you think there's an app, like, is my child poisoning me?
You put your, like, the heart rate app on the iPhone 6, so you can just put your finger to the camera lens and see if it registers anything.
You just dip your phone in whatever drink you're drinking. It's like, no, not poison today. Although
so
you
I
are drinking
question.
Shitty
you're
coffee.
You're joking, Daniel, but that might be out there. You never know.
I have a question.
Always.
What is the right age for a kid to start having an iPhone? And I ask
40.
This because... 3, yeah.
They, 40. I
oh,
said
40.
Actually.
Okay, I was like yeah. 3. Thank you, Tim Cook. But no, I mean, when I was young, right? It was always what's the right age to start going to a movie? You know, there's the debate of when should girls get their ears pierced, wear makeup, all of this kind of stuff. But now parents have to think about when should their kids have iPhones.
It's true. We were buying a gift for a girl's child's birthday party last year. And we were looking through the toy aisle, and it's the first time I'd really been in a girl's toy aisle in a very long time. Not revealing anything about myself. Just, didn't wander that way. Shut up. And what I was struck by was that there were toy cell phones, and the toy cell phones all said on them for ages 3 and up. Universally. And I thought, is that the age? At which we are now giving children electronic devices with which they can communicate to the entire world.
When I was in high school, I didn't get my first phone, like cell phone. It was actually a Nextel. I didn't really get mine until I was about 16. And it was really out of necessity more than anything else. It wasn't because I wanted it. It was just a little dinky little Nextel thing. This was like 2001, 2002. So they weren't anywhere near what we have now. But I mean, the only reason I had that was because I was staying after school a lot for theater rehearsals and choir rehearsals. And, you know, it was a good way to communicate with my parents, let them know if, you know, when rehearsal was over and because they were down the road or something. And so it was really out of necessity more than anything else. I mean, the idea of a cell phone as a means of communicating with friends and as a pastime, that's a few generations after mine.
Yeah, it was same thing for me, not the choir stuff. I'm not that gay, but
hey,
I had to go there. No, you know, I had to stay after for sports, and then I had a job. So yeah, it was the same way. It was about, you know, in case of emergency or to communicate with my parents for exactly the same reason. It wasn't until I got an iPhone in grad school in like 2007, I think it was, that I was like, hey, look at this. I can follow all the Red Sox scores ever. And now I'm to the point where I'm like, stop updating me on every hit in the Red Sox game. So that's kind of swung around. But yeah, I could never have conceptualized this as a kid, staying this connected. And to the point that if my parents took it away from me or took anything away from me, that I would poison them? How does that become normalized? Is this just one kid who's messed up?
I think we have to chalk it up to one really disturbed child, but the Corolla corollary here is how did this child become so fucked? Because the likelihood is that the parents did it to this child, by the way.
Right.
It's a much smaller chance that they are just deranged. So, had it coming, that's what I say.
Well, it's just one of those things, you know, like you see those YouTube videos of people texting. Do you see that video of the woman who was just in a mall walking and texting and she literally, her knees run right into a fountain and she plants head first into the fountain because she was too busy texting.
Wait,
she didn't know.
Wait. Did you just describe Fountainhead?
Oh my God. Oh, goodness, that might be the best, worst objectivist pun ever.
Oh. Fountain.
Oh God.
That's what I'm good for. That's what I'm here for, folks.
But we'll file that away. We might use it later. You know, that was a good one. No, but it's a cultural thing. I mean, people are just walking, looking at their phones, texting, and everything like that. They're so disconnected from reality. I mean, maybe this 12-year-old girl, her sense of self was so through social media, so through her phone, that in her prepubescent mind, when her mother took her phone away, it was like an attack on her identity, and so she fought back. I mean, if I had to psychologize and pull something out of my ass. But, I mean, it's the cultural thing.
That's what you pull out of your ass? It's not what I pictured.
Gerbil.
Hey, you know, that's a whole other discussion for another day.
So, someone who's not entitled is one Chris Borland, who plans to give back a huge portion of his signing bonus. If you're unaware, Chris Borland is a retiring San Francisco's 49er linebacker who was a very promising rookie this past year. Is that correct, Justin? Doesn't say in this article if he was a rookie or not.
Oh, I thought you were asking me if he was promising or not.
No, that he was a rookie. I think he was, and he was quite good. But he's leaving the NFL after 1 year for health reasons, saying that he was worried about the long-term health effects of head trauma. So he has to give back over $450,000 of his signing bonus.
He has to?
No, he doesn't have to.
No, it says that they would likely have to under the collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah,
well,
they
haven't said anything. Isn't that what the article said? That they haven't demanded it yet. He's doing it voluntarily.
Yes, they haven't demanded it yet, but he would likely have to.
I think it's an honorable thing to do. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
But then again, okay. I don't know. So,
so there are a couple things here. One, young guy, Chris Borland, going to give you one guess about his race. Not black, so pick another one. Anyone? Bueller?
Asian?
This is going to be important here in a second.
Klingon?
Chris Borland? Come on. It's one of the whitest names I've ever heard in my life. Couple things. He is retiring because of potential health reasons, but do you think he would be retiring if he legitimately had no backup plan? That's my question for you.
Someone who would make, I mean, there's so much context here. Someone who would make this smart of a decision? No. Because his decision was too well reasoned and his explanation was too well thought out for me to think that that kind of a person would do it without a backup plan.
Do you think that maybe there's something else here going on that we don't know about? Because I thought there was, and my hero Adam Carolla thought there was, and he did the research and proved both he and I correct.
No, I actually, that never crossed my mind because I didn't give a shit. Because I was like, oh wow, here's a stupid story about trying to make concussions a bigger deal than they were.
No, because it seemed odd to me that it's not like people don't know that there's a risk, right? It's pretty friggin' clear at this point that there is a risk to playing football, but there's a risk to Alaskan crab fishing. In fact, it's a way riskier risk and less money.
But the fact that before you even talk about the specifics about this, you've just completely exposed the story because no one, not the NFL, not ESPN, is reporting the fact that he's doing and leaving for a backup plan. He's doing this retirement and leaving for a backup plan. They're just reporting that he's doing it because he got concussions and he's worried about getting more and getting brain damage.
Right. But it just so happens that Chris Borland's father runs one of the biggest financial firms in the world, the Borland Group. And he'll be starting there as a financial analyst this coming year.
But
three times what he was making in the NFL, by the way.
But even if that's the case, I don't know. You're making it sound like there's something wrong with that.
I don't. There's nothing wrong with his decision. And I think what Justin and I are going to harp on is there's something wrong with the media portrayal here.
Correct. I didn't realize that this was just some whim of a rich kid that he happened to be good enough to play football, so he did it while it didn't hurt him. And then when it potentially hurt him, because he didn't really love it that much, it was just like, hey, this is something I can do. Now I'm just going to go do this other thing I can do. He doesn't, it just, when you see this kind of behavior, it doesn't seem like somebody who actually has any real set of values. It's just kind of like, this is the example that leftists will complain about when they say the 1% can do whatever they want and it's not fair type deal. These rare people who are good enough and smart enough and they're well off enough because of their family that they don't have to worry about things, so they don't take the world seriously and they're just taken care of. This is the kind of person people complain about, and he's being raised up as some sort of hero for exposing the NFL's concussion issues by retiring early.
Yeah, see, I didn't know all that. I read the story, but the only thing I really read about it that I really gleaned from it was that he was giving the money back because he wasn't going to stick around instead of trying to fight to keep it. So I don't know.
Well, that's the point too.
Honorable comment in that case.
Well, that's the thing. I didn't know that either until Daniel just said it, and that's the entire point. The fact that that's not honest reporting. It's not good reporting.
Correct. No one thought to ask, well, what are you doing? Because this is the other part of it, and it does have to go a little bit with what Justin was saying, right? There are players in the NFL, predominantly African-American players, who don't have a backup option, who can't say, I'm going to go work for my dad's enormous financial firm. They're accepting the risk that they know is there in exchange for this huge amount of money and potential fame or whatever it is. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But don't hold this guy up as a paragon of virtue without reporting on this other element of it. Be honest about it. Be fair in the reporting. That's all I want.
Well,
so,
I thought
that was interesting.
It's very interesting, and I think it's a good time to bring up such an example that you're talking about.
Yes, we have to give props to a Ravens player.
Unfortunately.
That's not what we like to do here. But
this is the first time I'll ever watch a Ravens game from now on and be like, there's somebody I don't completely hate on that team.
Sort of in response to the Chris Borland retirement, Ravens player John Urschel, and I don't know what position he plays, do you?
I think he's a left tackle.
Oh, okay.
Of course.
Anyway.
You know, on the test, the Wonderlic test, where they test intelligence, what the position that scores the highest is consistently?
What?
Offensive line.
Oh.
Do you know why offensive linemen have to be that smart?
To have to read the defense?
Read the defense and know the plays. Because they have to block for everyone on offense. So they have to know where every player on the field is going to go, and they also have to know how every lineman is going to go. So they have to be in sync as far as their blocking patterns or the entire play is over. And they also have to know, about leverage and that kind of stuff with the other guys. So they have to read things very quickly and be aware of everything that's going on in the play.
Yeah, makes sense. There's a lot going on that people don't understand. So anyway, John Urschel starts off this column called, he writes, why I still play football. And he says, I envy Chris Borland. And then he starts to tell about how he's met Chris and he's one of the toughest players he's ever been with. But then he starts to give a little bit of his own background, which is something that most people will find unfamiliar in terms of football players, which is he has a bachelor's and master's in mathematics, all with a 4.0, and numerous published mathematical journal articles. He's a mathematical researcher in his spare time, doing research in areas, I'm going to try to get this all right, numerical linear algebra, multi-grid methods, spectral graph theory, and machine learning. He's also an avid chess player and plans to be a titled champion one day. And he says that playing in the NFL has nothing to do with money for him. He could go be a math researcher and make plenty of money to take care of his family.
Well, even said beyond that, the thing that really I loved about this article where he said he's an NFL player, but he lives on less than $25,000 a year. So even he drives what do you say he drives, a Kia or something like that?
A Nissan Versa hatchback.
Right. Wow.
Used.
Right. So look at that. It proves that not all of these people are obsessed with the money and, being destroyed by it.
Correct. And he said his mother has always been very supportive. She asks him after the end of every season if he wants to continue playing or not. But he says that he is going to continue playing because I play because I love the game. I love hitting people. It's very interesting that that's the quote they chose to highlight, but he continues. There's a rush you get when you go out on the field.
Like, I think he wrote this article. I don't think they chose to highlight that. I think he wrote that whole thing.
I assume the editors choose, like, the pull quotes and stuff.
Okay.
But maybe not. I don't know. That was just be standard practice. There's a rush you get when you go out on the field, lay everything on the line, and physically dominate the player across from you. This is a feeling I'm, for lack of a better word, addicted to, and I'm hard-pressed to find anywhere else. My teammates, friends, and families can attest to this. When I go too long without physical contact, I'm not a pleasant person to be around. So that's a very interesting take that we absolutely do not get from the sports reporting media. Ever.
What do you find so interesting about it?
It's a focus on the quality of the experience he has in this thing that he cannot get anywhere else. And it wouldn't matter if he was doing it like in high school, which he did, or in college, which he did for no money, or in the NFL. It's this type of experience. He wants to be great at it because he gets this rush from it. But we don't hear about that. All we hear about is contracts and head trauma. So it makes it seem like either you're giving up your health for the sake of money or giving up money for the sake of your health. Well, false dichotomy, media.
Well, it's because the culture at large, you know, the people who don't watch sports, and I guess I could until recently include myself, but even though I don't hold this particular opinion, I think a lot of people view athletes as dumb. And I think as in the same way that a lot of people seem to think that if you're a soldier, it's because you were on the bottom rung of your high school class. You didn't get into any colleges, so you have to do this so that you have a chance to go to a college and things like that. So, I mean, I wonder if people kind of view athletes in that same way. And that's probably where a lot of this comes from, why they don't report on things like this.
What about the fact, though, that he calls it an addiction?
Well, to be fair to this guy, he did say for lack of a better word. I don't think he really means addicted in that sense. I think he means it's something that he has such a strong attraction to that he would never give it up.
So it's love. He can't just say he loves it?
Oh, he's a man. He can't say he loves anything.
If he says he loves anything, he ends up in it's the Baltimore Ravens locker room.
Exactly. Then he's got to go hang out with that Michael Sam dude.
Well, he did say if he goes without physical contact for a long time that he's not a happy person.
Well, that was the thing I thought was interesting about this, was another thing I thought was interesting was his acknowledgement of mind and body. So he's very, very cerebral, right, with all of this mathematics stuff. The fact that he can be a professional mathematician on the side of being a professional football player, although it's probably what he does in the off season. But the fact that he also acknowledges the importance of him of physicality. You don't see that often, especially from the more academic types.
It's true. The only other person I've seen it recently in was that Tom Brady article about his training, where he talked about the huge significance of training his mind as well as his body.
So what we're saying is, once your contract is up with the Ravens, come play for the Patriots. They will pay you nothing. That will be a very Patriots-friendly deal. So everyone will, is happy.
They will happily zero your salary.
Yeah. I think you can meet them at the bottom on the negotiating table. And then you'll actually be on a winner. So yeah. It's a win-win for everyone.
They'll sign you for 1 year for base salary.
Speaking of mind-body dichotomies, let's talk about the premiere of iZombie in TV with JML. Since January, we've been doing a lot of reviewing on the podcast of the mid-season premieres of all of the replacement shows for the networks. We've seen a few good ones. We've seen one show really take off, even though it's really bad, right? Empire took off. Battle Creek is good. It's probably going to be canceled, though. Apparently, the ratings aren't very good. So we've seen sort of all over the map. Daniel, you're a big fan of Fresh Off the Boat.
Yep. Still loving it.
Yeah. So another show that's been getting a lot of hype as a midseason replacement is the CW's iZombie. Have you guys heard anything about this show?
I didn't know it was CW. Okay.
Doesn't that explain a lot that it's CW?
Yeah, it's just going to be a chicky show.
Yeah, it's a chicky show, which isn't a surprise because of who made it. It's by Rob Thomas, the creator of Veronica Mars. It is based off of a comic book. So that's the first thing, right? Is it's based off a comic book. That's the source material. It's not something he came up with completely on his own. But I've been avoiding this show for one simple reason. Can you guess the reason?
The title?
Well, the title is bad, but the title doesn't really fit the show. It's actually a really bad title for the show. I think they're just trying to be hip and cool.
Yeah. Didn't they know that the eye went out a long time ago? Come on, people. The only people who can use it and be cool is Apple. Stop it. Are you avoiding it because you are a competitor in the zombie genre and you think you've done better work?
Well, I do think I've done better work, but that's not why I haven't been watching it. I haven't been watching it because I'm a zombie purist. And I believe that zombies shouldn't be able to think and to speak. They should not
even
be humanized.
Speak, huh?
What?
But they can't speak, like, anything? Not even, like, a little bit?
Well, okay, I mean, they can go,
well, okay, no, that's moaning. Can they say brains?
Brains.
No, I always saw that as sort of a joke, an over-the-top parody. I didn't think zombies actually did that.
Oh, I like my zombies to say brains.
No, that's so hokey.
I like, they're zombies! I like hokey.
So, I finally bit the bullet and I watched this show because it was on Hulu and I was like, okay, I'll see what this is and whatever, blah, blah, blah. Now, I will say this, they handle the zombie thing in an interesting way and it's kind of just swept under the table. So the way the zombie thing is handled is she was scratched, she became a zombie, and she has to eat brains. But if she doesn't eat brains, she gets dumber and becomes more traditional zombie-like. But as long as she eats brains, she stays as smart as a normal human.
Does she look like a zombie?
This is how they handle it in the show, and they have a cheap budget. She had dark hair, and then she has blonde hair after she becomes a zombie, and she has really pale skin.
So she's Ally McBeal?
Basically. She's basically Veronica Mars. If you want to get down to it. She's Veronica Mars if Veronica Mars wasn't a detective. But they do work this in. So this show, what it ends up being is Veronica Mars meets Dead Like Me meets Pushing Daisies. And what I mean by that is, this is what the show is about. This girl was an overachiever. She was a medical resident. She was going to be a heart surgeon. She was going to marry the perfect guy. And she never goes to parties. But her nemesis at school decides to invite her to a party. And her fiance says, you're going to spend the rest of your life with me, just go to the party. She goes to the party, there's a zombie attack at the party. The zombies are started due to some new drug. So it's not even really zombieism, it's just a drug has made people sick. And she gets scratched, she becomes a zombie, she quits her job, she takes up a job at a morgue, where she's the assistant to the guy at the morgue, and that gives her access to brains. Now, the complicating factor here that makes it sort of like Pushing Daisies is it ends up being a procedural. So, Ellie, you actually might love this show.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
So it becomes a procedural when the Emmy, of course, the Emmy who works in the morgue, of course, reports to cops. And this one cop is trying to solve a case. He's this new young cop, and he's never solved a case before. And because she eats brains, she finds out that not only does it make her stay human, but she gets some of the memories of the brains she's eaten.
Oh,
people
God.
The brains she's eaten. So it helps
her. Oh, you just totally lost me.
It helps her solve the crimes.
Oh.
So it's like Pushing Daisies in the sense that it's about solving crimes using your knowledge of death. It's like Dead Like Me because she's still living her life even though she's dead, but she can't really be connected with people. And it's like Veronica Mars because she's got the same sort of attitude. I mean, she basically is Veronica. She's got the same sort of attitude and wit that Veronica Mars has. It's just sort of, she's like Kristen Bell light.
Do people know she's a zombie?
There's only one person who knows she's a zombie, and it's the medical examiner. Because she randomly took the job and he found out by doing his job that the brains were missing from the people she had examined and sewn up. And then he caught her eating brains and they talked about it. And he's trying to cure it. He thinks he can cure the zombieism.
So is, okay. Jesus. So is the cop guy going to fuck her? And then follow up point, is that necrophilia?
I don't know if he's going to fuck her because she made a point in the episode where at the end she was giving her like end of the episode, Veronica Mars, Georgia Lass from Dead Like Me narration spiel. And she was like, I can't have sex as one of her ways of not being able to connect with people. So apparently being a zombie means she can't have sex. I don't know where that was ever established, but they just established it in the show. But the cop is going to find out. They did the whole Clark Kent thing where they were rescuing the victims who were about to be killed, and he was in the house with the victims, and he told her to stay in the car. But when she stayed in the car, the murderer ran outside and shot her. And then the cop went outside to get her body and help her because he was like, oh, my God, she died when I was just having her help me. But then when he came back, she wasn't there. She had chased after the guy because she went full zombie when she got really angry, which made her be able to chase the car and jump on top of it. Because apparently going full zombie now means 28 days later zombies all the time. And he was like, didn't I see you get shot? And she was like, no, he missed. And I just fell over to act like he hit me. So they're going to do the whole, oh, look at the stupid ways Clark Kent can get out of Lois Lane knowing he's actually Superman.
Okay, this sounds beyond terrible.
It's not awful. It's not terrible. It's just kind of revealing of how television has evolved. And it's revealing of how Rob Thomas can't get past Veronica Mars, because it's basically, I mean, without the Veronica Mars element to it, there really wouldn't be any sort of appeal to it. And it, you know, it's revealing of how bad television back in the day actually was.
I would watch this show if they would commit the cop boyfriend character to trying to get laid, even though she says she can't have sex, just trying to see him surreptitiously get himself in there.
He might, you know, later on, but he's not the boyfriend. The boyfriend is the ex-fiance who they cleverly, she snuck over to his house to see him because she was like, oh, well, I have the courage now to go see him. And when she looked in the window, he was playing Dead Island with another girl. So she ran away all upset. So that was supposed to be clever because he's killing zombies. Because, oh, he would kill me because a fucking sentient zombie, everyone's going to think of that's the same thing as a normal zombie.
Because I can see the cop now. I'm still on this, by the way. I don't care about the fiance. I can see the cop now being like, you know what they say about a man's brains being in his penis.
See, I would be interested if she were eating brains. I would be interested in throwing a little ratatouille kind of thing. You know, now she learns to eat brains, but she also learns how to cook them. And she knows what herbs and what spices go. And while the other zombies are content to eat brains raw, she's determined to make a real meal out of brains. She knows how to dice them julienne, saute them with the right oils and the right butter.
She did mix them in with noodles and hot sauce.
Yeah!
So she might do that later on. But I mean,
she
that's
is zombie.
Too much like Hannibal.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, the chef zombie kind of thing. I would be interested in that. But other than that, everything else, it sounds a little bit like Arrow, another show on the CW, but not as good as Arrow.
Yeah, this sounds like a chicky show.
I'm not gonna
watch this.
I wouldn't recommend it. It's not great. It's not awful. Not the worst.
I suppose if you like the stuff that the CW does, you're gonna like this.
Yeah. And, you know, it'll get some Veronica Mars fans in there because it's kinda like the closest thing you'll ever get to Veronica Mars ever again. I actually think one of the locations was one of the locations from the Veronica Mars movie. So, you'll see that all over it. It's got those fingerprints on it. It's got echoes of that. So there'll be some nostalgia in there. But beyond that, there's really not a reason to keep watching it. I wouldn't be surprised to see it stay on because CW has a really low bar for ratings.
I really like Arrow, and Arrow's on the CW, so.
You just like the shirtless guy on all the commercials.
Dude, he does this workout that, like, he does, like, these pull-ups on the show, and the pull-up bar has, like, these, like, ledges or these little, like little slots. So every time he does a pull-up, he literally jumps up to the next level, pulls himself up, and then pulls himself up again and chomp. Like he has, it's awesome.
So it's the American Ninja Warrior of pull-ups?
That's the salmon ladder for American Ninja Warrior.
That's exactly what I was saying. Or the cliffhanger for American Ninja Warrior.
Dude, I saw that and I was just like, I love this man. I mean, I love the show.
Well, let's move on to a show that was actually good, yet was still canceled, yet was picked up by Yahoo, and I don't even know how it still exists. We said we were going to talk about the Community premiere. Did you guys watch it? What did you think of it?
I watched the first episode, and I watched a little bit of the second episode. Yeah, it's Community. I mean, in the typical Community style, the first episode was very meta, right? It was very much about moving forward, but changing and having to deal with a new cast, even Abed's super meta about everything. It was Community. It had cute, quirky jokes. The Dean is there. He's funny.
Yeah, I thought the first episode was more interesting than the second one, though, because the second one was just sort of like, let's put them in a small room because they did the whole Dean virtual reality thing, and it was just kind of like all in one. Those three characters, the Dean, Padgett Brewster's character, and Jeff, we're all in that same room for like half of the episode, so it was just kind of boring. But at least in the first one, they had that, they had a very strong theme where they had the whole Abed and the Padgett Brewster character where they were trying to negotiate, you know, the being creative and being unique with being realistic and being able to survive.
Yeah.
And that was the whole episode was, you know, and that's what you're saying, Daniel, that's kind of meta because Community kind of drummed itself off television because it was too quirky and unique, right?
Right. And then, you know, in order to survive, they had to be shoved onto Yahoo. They couldn't even get Netflix. They had to go to Yahoo.
Well, was it because they couldn't get Netflix? We'll never know. I mean, I would think this would have been a big draw for Netflix.
I don't know. I do find it very funny, though, that Netflix is the number one advertiser, at least for me, when I'm watching it on Yahoo.
On Yahoo screen, Netflix is the number one advertiser. That's kind of funny.
It's always showing me ads for The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which if they were actually really good at their targeting, they would know I've already watched. So, fail!
What I don't understand is how does Yahoo Screen make money? Like, I thought I was going to have to subscribe to watch Community. Do they just make it off of advertisements?
That's it for now. I mean, I assume there's some future plan, but the new Yahoo, she's not new anymore, but Marissa Mayer, she's sort of doing a Jeff Bezos approach lately, which is just throw everything at the wall. Throw everything at the wall. Something will land. So we'll see.
Right. So Community, it's Community. If you love it, you'll love it. You'll like it. And we'll see if they do a movie after this because they wanted six seasons in a movie, right?
Yeah. I listened to an interview with Dan Harmon the other day on the Gilbert Godfrey Amazing Colossal podcast. And he's a pretty determined guy. He's immensely gross, I've found out, and a bit of a D-bag leftist, but he's super determined.
Why is he gross?
He just had a, like, he opened up the show with a story about him putting a marker up his butt when he was masturbating. I didn't know any of this about Dan Harmon.
Yeah, he's a little crazy.
Yeah, but he's very determined. He has a vision and he wants to get it done and he's gonna get it done, damn it.
So he does want to do a movie?
I think he does, yes. According to that interview.
Does he have like an epic way he wants this all to end or is he just flying by the seat of his pants?
I think it's more the latter.
That's unfortunate. He just wants to do it to prove he can do it at this point, right? Cause he's a stubborn ass.
Yeah, basically.
Alright. Well, speaking of somebody else that people wish would go away, M. Night, however you say his name, Shyamalan.
Shyamalan,
and Ding Dong. What the twist is, did we say that at the same time?
Jinx.
Pinch is poke. Executive producing, and I don't know if he's showrunning, I don't know who the showrunner of the show is, a show on Fox called Wayward Pines that they just released the trailer for. I put the trailer.
And it stars
the
black guy who's apparently the only black guy Fox can get to put on any show.
Yeah, I was going to, you took my joke from later. I was going to say Terrence Howard is in every show on Fox now. Come on.
He's the resident black guy.
So I put the trailer in the outline, so I'm sure Elliot hasn't watched it.
I seem to have missed that one.
Yeah. Well, I'm shocked.
I'll tell you this though. I like Matt Dillon, so I'm kind of looking forward to seeing a comeback from him.
Yeah. So beyond Terrence Howard, it's the main character is Matt Dillon. It also stars Madame Gorski from Sucker Punch. So all you Zack Snyder fans out there, she's in this. And there were a couple other good actors in there. Oh, Reed Diamond's in there. So you may remember Reed Diamond from Franklin and Bash, Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Dollhouse. So he's been on a bunch of stuff. So the cast is pretty good.
Yeah, it's a who's who of people who you go, yeah, I know that person. I've seen them in things. I don't know their name.
The people who have been in genre shows and people have hoped that it would have their career take off.
Yeah, bunch of those people.
So it's another one of those. So, yeah. Daniel, what did you think of the trailer?
I thought it was legitimately creepy, which I think is a positive thing since it's trying to be and it's not a romantic comedy. Basically, have you given the... I was listening to you. Did you give the synopsis?
No, you can give the synopsis. That's fine.
Okay. Matt Dillon? What's his name?
Yeah, Matt Dillon.
Yeah.
Love okay. Matt.
For a minute there, I thought I was picturing Matt Damon and that wasn't...
Correct. Matt Damon.
Yeah. No, Matt Dillon finds himself in this mysterious little creepy town where everyone loves their town and there are rules for the town, like you can't ever leave the town.
And when the phone rings, you have to answer it.
Yeah. And so the phone rings, of course, in the trailer and Matt Dillon picks it up and the sexual predator voice in the other line goes, "You have to kill the man across from you." It sounds like the guy from Saw a little bit. And he hangs up the phone and goes, "Telemarketer," but the guy across from him knows exactly what is supposed to happen. So he tries to escape the town. He can't. Murder happens. Craziness ensues. What's going on with this town? We'll never know because it's M. Night Shyamalan. What a twist. I don't know. Looks okay.
I'm going to watch it. I think it looks pretty good. I think it's worth giving a try here. Looks a little more creative than a lot of stuff that's on television. Although I did notice there was a Lost reference at the beginning. I don't know if it was a Lost reference or a Lost influence, but the trailer opens with somebody laying, it looks like, in the forest, and his eye opens up.
So what you're saying is...
It ends in a church.
On a mysterious island.
Yeah.
And it's going to go 6 seasons and have no meaning.
And end in a church, yeah. No, Lost had a meaning. It just wasn't a good meaning.
I refuse to acknowledge it had a meaning.
The meaning of Lost was other people are most important. That was the meaning of Lost.
Yeah, I know. Which is why I refuse to acknowledge it.
Because that's not a meaning. It's an
la 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 evade.
All right. Well, something else that we've evaded for many other seasons that is finally gone and over is Glee. And I just thought we should acknowledge the end of Glee, maybe say a few thoughts about it, because we also did acknowledge the end of How I Met Your Mother, which had an effect on the television landscape. And Glee, especially when it came out in the beginning, was a very huge event in television and had a huge influence on it. I mean, Ryan Murphy is now able to do American Horror Story because of Glee being so big.
Glee! Elliot, do you watch Glee? Did you watch Glee?
Do you ask me that just because he's gay?
Yes.
I watched the first 2 seasons, but I think that... I know, I mean, I like a cohesive story. And as much as I love watching gay characters on TV, when every week the one gay kid is the one that's getting like the big dramatic moments and all that stuff, it's just kind of like, okay, we're losing sight of the other characters in the show.
Yeah.
And I just hate incoherent, non-cohesive stories. Like characters acting one way one week and then acting a completely different way the next week and, there's no rhyme or reason to why certain people are friends one week and then it's just completely scattershot. And I'm not a fan. I was not a fan of it. And halfway through the second season, I was kind of like, you know what? I'm just not feeling this anymore.
Right. And that was one of the major problems with Glee, right? Was the writing was, as you're saying, it was week to week. They would do plots that could be an entire season and they would do them in like one episode. I remember there was one episode or 3 episodes or something where they made Sue Sylvester principal of the school. Well, that could have been a season-long arc, and they did it that quickly. And as Elliot said, because of this, they would just keep changing things from week to week, and it made no sense. Now, the other problem with the writing for me was the obvious social agenda, which Elliot hinted at by saying that the gay character got all the big moments.
It's true. I actually had almost the exact same arc in terms of watching the show as Elliot did. I enthusiastically watched the first season. I thought it was all right. And then when the second season started and basically every single show was about the gay character and everything bad was happening to him and everyone around him was an evil monster, I decided that it wasn't worth it. That's not the show I signed up for, especially sure. because season one was so radically different.
I mean, I think that the whole, for those of us who grew up in the performing arts, like if you were in high school, I was in musical theater, I did drama in high school and chorus. I mean, I really wanted to see more along those lines. You know, kids who perform and how difficult it is, you know, to transition from a high school performer to a professional one. And, you know, there are a lot of stories that could be told there. You know, I mean, I knew people in high school who, their musical talents came from practically nowhere almost because their parents were not musically talented. They didn't have any musical talent anywhere in the family except for them. You know, and there are other ones, you know, people who they had like no money. So when they had to get, when it was time to do the musical, I mean, everybody in their family had to contribute clothing from their own closets so they could sell the costumes and because, you know, the family didn't have money to buy costumes or anything like that. I mean, there's so many stories that I remember from my experience in high school that I would have loved to have seen dramatized on Glee. And they didn't go anywhere near that. And part of the problem was that they were starting to write they wanted to do like the special theme episodes. Oh, it's a Lady Gaga episode. It's a Britney Spears episode. It was about the artist. And when it becomes a jukebox musical, I think that you kind of, it takes you away from creating a sustainable arc.
I have no problem with the whole Britney episode, Lady Gaga episode. I think that can be worked within the show overall, and I think it became a jukebox musical for the reasons we said about the writing before, where it just became every week they just did whatever they could to make the Britney thing work. They didn't try to be creative and actually put any artistry into it. I had a similar viewing experience to you guys as far as watching the show, but I can still remember the moment that I realized the show was done for and didn't care anymore. Do you guys
was that,
remember
the father? It was an episode of the father. I know we talked about this.
It had to do with the father, and it had to do with Finn, and it had to do with the gay kid.
Finn's father.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was the problem I had with, you know, Finn's father eventually falls in love with the gay kid. What was the gay kid's name? I can't remember.
No, it's Kurt.
Kurt, right. So Kurt, Finn's father falls in love with Kurt's mother, and they're going to get married. So Finn is the,
It's backwards. You have Kurt's mother falling in love with Finn. No, it was Kurt's father falling in love with Finn's mother.
Okay,
what did
you say? Because Michael O'Malley played Kurt's father.
Yes.
Right, okay, so I had it
That's
backwards.
Really good job. I like this performance.
Right. So they fall in love, and Finn, who is the, you know, the high school star football player who is on the Glee Club, and Kurt, who's the stereotypical gay guy, are told they have to live together in the same room. Now this makes Finn really uncomfortable, and he gets super angry, and he calls him either a queer or a faggot or something like that. Does anyone remember what the exact word was?
He says, well, we have to set up the context, because the context of the episode, Kurt has been kind of pulling some strings. He's decorated their room that they're going to share, and he's done so very flamboyantly, and Finn is very uncomfortable, and it all just kind of builds up to this moment where Kurt kind of tells him, you know, take your faggy lamp and take your faggy chair, blah. And that's when Kurt's father walks in and basically kicks Finn out in a really very tense scene.
Right.
And
so you're making my case even more for me about how bad this was, because the episode actually ended with Finn having to apologize to Kurt. And it was never acknowledged in the episode that nobody asked Finn what he thought if he wanted to move in with a gay kid. If that made him comfortable or uncomfortable, it was just assumed that he had to accept that and not say anything and swallow his feelings than anything that would bother him. Never addressed in the episode.
I don't even think it was the issue that Kurt was gay. It's that Kurt, we know that Kurt was finagling things. The character had a crush on Finn, and he was doing this because he wanted to get close to Finn. It was a very stalkerish thing. And one of the things that was really interesting when this storyline was going on, it was that the gay fans that were watching this show, because I was reading the reviews and stuff on After Elton and a lot of these other gay sites, they did not like this storyline. Not because they were on Finn's side, not on Kurt's side. because they understand completely where Finn was coming from. Like, this guy is manipulating situations to share a room with someone that he has a crush on, that he knows he's not going to have a chance with. And Finn erupts and says what he says. But, and the scene completely just, I mean, they were trying to appeal to a gay viewership, but a lot of the gay viewership that watched the show wound up siding with Finn, not with Kurt, which I thought was really interesting.
Very interesting. I did not know that. But that's, I think that's toward when I stopped watching the show, because I had a very similar reaction. And it's sort of my, you know, it's my question about the transgender thing as well, not to equate the two necessarily, but it's like, why does one side have to accommodate and the other side not? If we're going to play completely relativistic here, then both sides are equally correct.
Right.
So, yeah. Goodbye, Glee. You shall not be missed.
Yeah,
at least not by this podcaster.
Yeah, here's a slush in your face, Glee. You're gone.
Bye-bye.
What's not missed by another podcaster is social media. We go off the grid with Elliot Rivera. You live your life online. I'll pull a plug and
live mine. Let me start off this week by saying, so a bit of good news. Actually, most of it is good news, but I've lost another couple of pounds since the last time that I talked.
Woo
woo! So yes, my journey into fitness is kicking into gear. I had a pretty interesting week last week because, well, I'll just break this news now. I got sued for something.
For being off social media?
No, not for being off social media. But my being off of social media helped me, and I will tell you why. A few years ago, before I really kicked my ass financially to get myself into a better financial state and to, you know, just kind of cut out the credit cards and all this stuff and just be debt-free and to stay that way, I did overindulge with credit cards a few years ago. And they disappeared. Like, they stopped calling me. They stopped sending me notifications and stuff like that. And 3 years have gone by. Nothing. And now that I'm a homeowner here in Florida, I don't know if somehow that triggered an alarm or something or set up a flag, but they found me. And so they sent me, they served my father, because he's the one who answered the door. And it's funny because I was thinking about, when he told me the news and he handed me the paperwork, I didn't freak out. I didn't freak out because I just knew that I knew what to do in that situation. I knew exactly what needed to be done, and we resolved it, you know, because it was just a matter of paying the bill. We had the money saved up. I had it in my savings, and so I just paid it, and, you know, it's set, it's taken care of, it's over. But the point that I want to make, the reason why I'm bringing it up is because when you don't have a lot of people trying to tell you what to do and try to give you advice, even if they're trying to be helpful, it's a very productive way for you to come to your own conclusions. And more often than not, you know what you need to do in a situation, or you know that you have a better grasp of the options when you don't have a million voices on the internet trying to tell you what to do. Because I know that a month ago, I probably would have gone on Twitter and kvetched about it, or on Facebook, and all probably mostly well-meaning people would probably try to offer their solutions, and I would have felt caught or trapped, or just maybe I would have come to the decision I did initially anyway, but I didn't, it would have been a much more stressful situation. And so being off social media, being off of Facebook, being off of Twitter, being off of all these things gave me a certain confidence that I think, not that I was lacking before, but I think I kind of put aside, because when it was presented to me, I had the confidence to know that I knew what to do, and I did it, and I fixed it, and I'm feeling very proud of that. So my take home nugget, I think, is if you feel like if you're facing a decision, you don't know what you're doing, and all these well-meaning people on social media are trying to give you advice or point you in the right direction, maybe the best thing to do is just kind of shut it all out, step back, and just kind of let yourself come to your conclusion. You probably already know the best thing to do, or at least you probably have a better grasp of the options available to you without a lot of people shouting in your ear. So just sometimes step away and just listen to yourself. And that's what I have to say for the day.
So is this going to inform the way you use social media when you return?
Yeah, I mean, I've already decided that I'm not going to come back to Twitter. Or I'm just going to pretty much stick with Facebook. I think that there's just, I think it's a little better sanity-wise for me to stay there and maybe get off of Twitter and get off of the other social media, like Instagram and all that. I think I'm just going to stick with Facebook when I come back.
Does this mean I'm going to lose a follower?
Probably. You already did, because he deactivated.
Yeah.
But forever.
Sorry, buddy. Sorry. I'll direct people your way, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Be like, yeah, follow Daniel T. Richards.
But is the issue you're describing with Twitter itself, or is it with the usage of Twitter? Because I would never use social media to sort of crowdsource what I should do, and I would never talk about something that personal on social media. I might call friends and get advice on it or something, or call friends to gripe about it, but I would never put that out there and say, what do people think, or even talk about it on there. I mean,
Go ahead.
I was going to say, maybe I'll talk about traffic or something as like, you know, this is something that's going on, or like on Instagram, I put a picture the other day of a pickup truck with a handicap sticker that was parked next to a handicap spot where there was no spot. So I put stuff like that there, but it's not like stuff that's personal to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think you and I are different in terms of how we manage our accounts. I think I'm more of an emotional user when it comes to that sort of thing. I think I really use it when I'm feeling emotional, when I'm angry, when I'm frustrated, when I'm happy, when I'm, you know, on a mission to get a certain point of view out. I think I'm a little bit more, it's a little bit more me to do that. It's probably not the wisest thing to do, I'll grant that, but it is how I tend to use it. And so if I'm, you know, maybe for a while, I'll just do without Twitter, you know, and just kind of not do that and just kind of use Facebook where it's a little bit more suited to me, where I can enjoy, you know, I can talk to my family, I can talk to my friends, and I won't necessarily just tweet at strangers all over the internet and put things out there that don't need to be out there.
Daniel, what do you think about the use of Twitter in general?
I think that social media in general, not just Twitter, but social media does affect the way we think about things, whether we are conscious of it or not, because it's a completely different way of interacting with other human beings. I mean, the word social is right there in front. It's necessarily a way of accessing information from basically a billion non-experts, right? So I think even if we don't, if we don't actively search for social opinions about a given thing, it is already starting to affect the way we think about it in general. And usually that's through mediation of things. So it's saying, like, thinking in your head, you know, what would other people think about this, or what would be the reaction if I had to remove a job from my Facebook page, for instance, or if I had to move, or if I ended my relationship with someone. Those kind of things. Even if you don't put them on social media necessarily, they're going to be discussed there. People are going to think about them there. They're going to see the news there from other people. So I think it's good. What Elliot's doing is awesome. And I recommend if everyone has the ability to do it, they absolutely should. And I even now on a daily basis have to shut down for an hour or two. Otherwise I just go insane because there is a lot of clutter and it messes with the wiring upstairs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I guess I just don't pay that much attention during the day. I mean, I use it as like a messenger program, but I'm not on there like communicating with people because, I mean, even today I just got sucked into a discussion for the first time in a long time and the first time in the Walking Dead community about a debate about the Walking Dead. And literally in the middle of this podcast, I just unsubscribed from a thread because the people are just being so stupid that I don't even want to hear what they're saying. So I guess I'm just more disconnected even though I'm on it.
Yeah, and again, I don't necessarily think you have to be directly connected. It's just, it completely changes the way we interface with the world. So people, for instance, report having social media anxiety over major life decisions. Even if there's someone who has never reported sharing anything on social media, they know that their friends are on social media. They know that their significant other might be on social media or their employer. And so they have an anxiety about what's going to go on there. So it completely changes the way they think about that given thing. Is that a good thing? It's a thing.
I don't, it just I don't is. Understand. I don't understand. What is this social media anxiety?
So let's say you, because of some negative reason, had to move.
Okay.
Even if you don't report that on social media, you personally, uh-huh, it's going to be discussed on social media by people you know.
Okay.
And so, theoretically, or at least for a certain percentage of people, have reported that that creates anxiety for them.
Define disgust on social media.
People are going to, you know, tweet out like, need your address, which is going to be made public, or on
Facebook.
Never
happened to me.
Okay, maybe you are the one human being solely on the planet who is completely 100% unaffected by anything that happens on social media.
Well, I mean,
but I don't
look,
think that demystifies, I don't think that negates the phenomenon.
I'm about to change apartments and people are going to help me move, so I assume people are going to have phone conversations with each other and maybe IM conversations about each other, or make a quick comment about, hey, did you see Justin moved up to Anaheim? Like, whoop-de-frickin'-do. Like, that's going to happen. But I don't think people, like, ask for your number over social media or tweet out about your address unless you're inviting that sort of behavior. Like, I've drawn a really strong line that I don't do that kind of stuff on social media because I make sure it doesn't influence my life in the way you're saying, because I let it do that for a long time.
Okay. So you just said you did let it at some point.
Well,
so it is
past,
a phenomenon.
But I let it, but the point I'm making is, it was me letting it happen to me. I've never assumed people were talking about me on social media. Like, I don't do something. I never did something and assumed people were like, oh, you know, or I assumed people would talk about it. Like, I don't know. That seems a sort of bit of narcissism to assume people are going to talk about something you do.
Well, social media is the ultimate narcissism. It's making every single person a celebrity in a certain right. It feeds the narcissistic beast.
All right. Fair enough.
That's right.
And you know what tracks the feeding of this beast here on the internet? Reddit. Let's talk about what we found on it in Reddit on Reddit.
Sony stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way, EA blows, Steam rocks, got Res for my Firefox. These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, whoring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
First Reddit, TIL, which is today I learned, that Hollywood tough guy, in quotation marks, because apparently he wasn't tough, I don't know, actor Humphrey Bogart was a male victim of domestic violence. His third wife, Mayo Methot, once stabbed him in the shoulder and threatened him with a pistol at a party.
T.I.L. Humphrey Bogart was named to a woman named Mayo.
Wait, why did you laugh at this, Elliot?
Well, because I'm like, okay, oh, she stabbed him with a fork in the shoulder and threatened him with a pistol at a party. Like, okay, do people not know what Hollywood was like in the 1940s and 50s? Like, these men, Bogie was a man, a man's man, okay? She probably stabbed him in the shoulder. He probably gave her a look and said, you know, watch, sweetheart, next time you should aim a little lower, and pulled it back out. She threatens him with a pistol. He probably grabs a pistol. I mean, men were different. They didn't whine about domestic abuse on the part of the woman. It's just the funny that how he phrases it this way. Tough guy, like in quotation marks, you know, oh, tough guy, Humphrey Bogart. Like, first of all, he was a tough guy. Humphrey Bogart is the man. All right. So take your quotation marks and shove them up your ass. And I mean, just the idea that, you know, that his third wife stabbed him and all, that it was domestic. I was like, no. That was, you know, Hollywood in the 40s and the 50s. Women were a little bit crazy, and men just took it. Not that I'm saying that that's right, but that's kind of how it was. Where there, you can't look at their behavior in their culture, in their society, and through our prism, you know, because we're looking at it through a different lens. We're like, you know, it's just, you know, that's how marriage like that was. Hollywood marriages could be very violent. They could be very, you know, tormentious, I guess, is that a word? I don't know.
Tumultuous,
yeah. That was just how, I mean, and you know, you don't, the idea that Humphrey Bogart would be a weak victim of domestic violence and stuff like that. And I'm not diminishing that there are men out there who really do get beaten up by their wives and that never gets talked about. I mean, like really, like baseball bat to the head get set on fire, they get emasculated. I mean, these things do happen, but the idea that Humphrey Bogart...
Mostly in Alabama.
But the idea that Humphrey Bogart is a poor victim in this issue, in this situation, no, he wasn't. I mean, he was a victim, but he took it like a man. I mean, am I wrong to say that?
Well, it certainly took a turn that I didn't expect for this article. I expected us to talk a little bit about male disposability, which is our new hot button issue.
Well, that's what I was intending to do. And I do think that Elliot's comments showed a little bit of assuming male disposability. I'm sorry, Elliot, to call you out on this, but the idea that that's just how women were and men learned to deal with that, isn't that part of the issue? I mean, I don't agree with the way this is being characterized by this Redditor about the whole quote-unquote tough guy. I don't think it makes him any less tough because he was stabbed with a fork and threatened with a pistol. But the fact that we would just sort of be like, oh, this isn't a big deal because that's how women were back then. And that's how women treated men. I mean...
My comment is that this Reddit poster is placing a situation back then in a context that you really can't. It's just, it was, different people, different time from where we are now. So to look at things through a social justice lens, from something that happened back then, I think that that's, you really can't do that. And I do not appreciate the quotation marks around Humphrey Bogart. I mean, around tough guy. You know what I mean? Like I just.
Also, according to the Wikipedia article, which it's not mentioned on the Reddit, she was a raging alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if a man is a raging alcoholic and stabs his wife, it's domestic abuse.
Mm-hmm. Today it's domestic abuse. Then it was, something a man dealt with.
What do you think?
I mean, I mediate
this issue between Elliot and I.
As usual, I think you're both right.
Well, I agree. Nice. I want to make it clear. I agreed with him that the use of the quotations in Tough Guy, that Humphrey Bogart isn't any less tough for having to have dealt with this.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
I'm not advocating male disposability, just to be clear. I'm not saying that he's disposable or that he wasn't abused. He probably was. But I'm just saying that, looking at older Hollywood actors, I'm trying to think of a good example. What's her name? The actress that was in The Snake Pit. I can't remember her name, but she used to go-
The Snake Pit from Indiana Jones? What? Like, is that a movie, The Snake Pit?
It was a film called The Snake Pit. I can't remember the actress's name, but
is it a porn movie?
No, Snake Pit? It was an old movie. It was actually around the era of Humphrey Bogart. But she used to go and get electroshock therapy very regularly because she had mental illness. And so she used to go get it done regularly, but when she would show up on set, she was working on a film, and if she had to leave to get her treatment, she would just tell them, well, I'll be back at 4, I have to get my treatments, and that's it. Because she knew she had a condition, she dealt with it. There was none of this running to social media, there wasn't any of this support group, social justice for the mentally ill. She knew what she needed to, she went and she just dealt with it because at the time, that's what you do.
Olivia de Havilland?
Was it Olivia de Havilland? I don't know. I don't know, that's a good question actually. But, I mean, it's really the idea that Humphrey Bogart, the attempt to cast him in the role of the victim here, when he didn't view himself as a victim. I don't know, I just kind of feel like this is-
Yeah, so there's a couple things here. I also want to note that her nickname was Sluggy, by the way. Not making that up.
Is that because she punches people?
Yeah, because she was known to be violent. Her nickname was Sluggy. Yeah. So there are a couple things going on. One is, I think there is an assumed premise here, as there is in most things. And the assumed premise is that violence against the man was acceptable, but violence against the woman wasn't. I understand that that exists. But at the same time, there's something I appreciate about Elliot's point, which is that, basically it was reported in the era, and I'm reading here on Wikipedia, that they just had a violent marriage, and it was just assumed that they were both beating up on each other, and that was their business, and no one was a victim. No, it wasn't that one was a victim or that the other was a victim, it's just that this was what they chose because they're both bizarre alcoholics, and her nickname was Sluggy.
It's not like, Slug, and he's not Frisco, it's just Sluggy?
just Sluggy, yeah.
Is that a better objectivist pun?
I think that's getting worse. So there is something I like about that we don't have to talk about, or at least in that era, they didn't talk about like, oh, who is really at fault here? Who's the victim? It was just, oh, look at those two kids always punching each other and stabbing each other in the shoulder.
Here, a wretched attempt.
Yeah. I don't know if that's better or worse than what we have, but it's certainly refreshingly different.
Okay. Is that your point?
That's all I got.
Okay. I mean, I think the issue here is just the use of the word victim. I mean, there's a victim in the sense that if somebody punches you in the face, you're a victim, right? They punch you in the face. Definitionally, you're a victim. But that doesn't mean you have to take on the modern mentality of a victim where, woe is me, end of the world, right? I mean, the Seahawks are a victim of the Patriots, right? Definitionally, are they not?
I don't know if I would call that victim, but I'll grant your point for the sake of hearing where the hell you go with this.
They're a victim of the Patriots Super Bowl loss. That's definition what the word victim means.
But victimized means crime.
Does it? To the Google.
I think so. To the Google. I'm on it.
Can you hear me typing?
Victim.
Victim definition.
As a result of a crime, accident, or other event or action.
A living creature killed as a religious sacrifice. That's what the Seahawks are.
Stupid water pigeons.
They were sacrificed at the altar, Belichick and Brady.
Right, if we're going with the third down definition, then yes.
Okay, yeah, what about a person harmed, injured, or killed as a result of a crime, accident, or other event or action? So, harmed...
I don't think that's an objective definition
other
of victim.
Events or
I
action.
Think that's a social justice definition of
the
victim.
The one I just read?
Harmed, injured, or killed as a result of another action or event? Yes. I don't think that person was a victim in that sense.
All right. So Merriam-Webster...
Because in that sense, like, I am a victim if I don't put my seatbelt on.
Yeah, you're but a victim of your own stupidity.
I wouldn't call that a victim.
How about Merriam-Webster? Someone or something that is harmed by an unpleasant event.
Yeah, I don't think these are objective definitions of victim. If you disagree with me and you agree with Justin, tweet at the midside and let us know. Because I don't think these are objective definitions of victim. I don't think they're capturing the concept of victim correctly.
I think you're using the modern social justice use of victim.
I'm saying that a victim has to be a result of a crime or something illegal. This is, a victim could be some a part of an accident or other event or action. Like, you know, like a random piece of spittle falls out of my mouth and you trip on it. You're a victim of my spittle.
Yes! Definitely!
No! Not a victim. Ugh.
All right, next Reddit.
Jesus.
Reddit is discussing the definition of the word victim this week. No, I'm just kidding. So next Reddit. Women are human and can behave badly, but this is not the place to post grievances. Posts designed to generalize female behavior imply that we overreact, that we make life hard for men, or that we're the cause of our own problems undermine the subreddit. So this was posted in the subreddit 2X Chromosomes, which has apparently been created as a safe place for women to discuss problems they have on a daily basis.
A safe place. We all need a safe place.
Well, okay, and that's the reason I put this in here, right? Because it sort of like follows from the last thing and talks about this whole male disposability. Does everyone need a forum everywhere? And this kind of goes back to, you know, the Starbucks thing where they're giving and taking a discussion about racism. Why do they have to be involved with racism? Why do women think they have to go to Reddit for this? Shouldn't there be forums for all of these things? And I don't mean internet forums. I mean the real use of the word forum, unless Dan wants to go look up the definition and tell me I'm wrong.
Well, a forum is a stone coliseum where people yell things to an audience.
Funny thing happened
up
there too.
Yeah. So, do you see the point I'm making? Why does there have to be a safe place for everyone everywhere to discuss their things without being bothered?
Yeah, I'm looking for the exact news story, but this came up this week where I think it was Huffington Post said that minorities and quote unquote victimized groups, you know, people who fell on spittle, need a place separate from whites where they can feel safe to discuss issues. And I think my favorite comment was they should also install their own water fountains.
Oh my gosh.
Because this is what it's coming to. We can't have an open discussion because we need a safe place. We need a safe place from all you whites who are dominating us. No, shut the fuck up.
They want to segregate themselves. Is that it?
Yes. It's so insane.
Isn't safe place supposed to be your home? Like, that's where you go at the end of the day to be away from everyone else?
How about your safe place is just that you don't give a flying fuck about other people? How about your safe place is that you stop being offended by every little tiny comment that comes out of someone's mouth or any look, male gaze, any white patriarchal privilege nonsense? How about your safe place is you be a mature fucking adult?
Yeah.
I might have gone off the rails there.
But. Well, that's okay. I liked it. I liked that seeing passion on this podcast, finally. We're only 9 episodes into season 3.
The passion is finally there.
The passion of the white privilege guy over here.
The passion of the Jesus Christ white people, would you shut up?
Exactly. Fucking safe place, my ass.
Elliot?
I think Daniel said everything I needed that I was going to say. I mean, it's just stupid, like a safe, you know, I mean, Post is like, or that we are the cause of our own problems. I hate to tell you this, people, but chances are 99.9% of the times you probably are the cause of your own problems. Because your problems are probably the results of the choices that you've made or didn't make. So yeah, they are kind of your fault. And that's not just true for women, it's true for all human beings. You're a volitional being, so if you have problems, chances are they're the results directly or indirectly of choices that you've made in the past. So you are kind of the cause of your own problems most of the time.
And I think that's the broader point. When people want a safe place, they just want a place where they can go and say whatever they want and not be beholden to reality. That's what it's really about.
I mean, think about extending this to everything. We need safe places at college where we don't have to experience other ideas that offend us or trigger our attitudes.
They already have that. When I was at Ithaca College, you could be written up for the speech code if you said something offensive.
Oh my god. We are raising a nation of coddled morons.
And on that note, let's put a cap on this episode. What did we learn this week? Daniel?
I learned that not all Ravens players are mass murdering fuckheads.
Elliot?
I've learned that we've probably reached the end of all the farce stories that we could do because we have come to the point where a little girl has tried to kill her mother over taking away her iPhone.
I'm telling you, you say that, but watch. Now you've given me a goal for next week to find something more farcical.
What did you learn this week?
I learned that Chris Borland is really just a spoiled rich kid who thinks he can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. And he has no sense of reality because he's just been completely taken care of his entire life, which is a completely different story than the media has been telling me.
Shock! Well, if you learned something this week, please let us know on our new Facebook page, facebook.com/TheMidSide, where a nice black banner will tell you to have a day and share it with people, get people to like it. So that we can grow this podcast, we can grow the audience, and we can take over the world and provide a safe place for all of you precious snowflakes to have your little opinions that offend everyone else.
And the safe place is the room you're going to be stuck in, because if you walk out of it and whine, I punch you in the face.
It'll be an actual safe with a combination lock and you'll never get out.
We'll shove you in it. So subscribe on iTunes, tell a friend, tell a friend, tell a friend, tell a friend, tell a friend. Thank you.
I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day!
And I think that's the broader part. What the fuck? Did anyone hear that echo?
Yes. I think it's coming through Elliot's speakers.
Elliot?
What?
There, it's better now.
I didn't hear anything.
I love you, Elliot.